Small Fondra. Little break now. Oh, excellent save. Must be 1-0 now. Brilliant double save from Ford.
Well, this week's guest is a man who laid down his gloves with a heart of gratitude and love earlier this summer. A long and winding road to the top eventually resulted in around 300 appearances for Millwall before a dream call-up to represent Ireland at international level rewarded the Galway man with 24 caps and a trip to the European Championships in 2012. Now looking ahead to next steps, perhaps in poetry, following that retirement announcement. David Ford, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Good morning, gentlemen, or good afternoon.
Or good evening.
Whenever people are listening. Yeah, I don't even know what day it is.
Rich normally does that, to be fair. Very well, thank you. Very well, David. Now, that retirement announcement, we're going to go straight onto it because I want to know the inspiration for that poem and the accompanying video. That was incredible stuff.
Yeah, well, it stems from, I suppose, obviously my Irish roots, and, you know, I'm a proud and passionate Irishman. And I just really wanted to capture something that would, you know, honour, I suppose, my ancestors, my roots, my family, my nation, what playing for my country did for me and stuff. And it was coming, a lot of people were kind of coming to me and asking me, you know, what am I doing this year? What's next? And I was just going to sail off into the sunset, like, you know. But a friend came to me and he said, look, it'd be a really nice thing to announce your retirement and stuff, and just let know really that the amount of supporters and people that, you know, really helped you along the way. And we just spoke about, you know, the possibility of maybe doing something that was certainly different and something that would be, I suppose, pioneering. That was along the lines of shooting a video and some poetry and getting the Irish Celtic bowler on in there and getting the bam, the drum banging, you know. So, yeah, we had great fun making it, and I was delighted with the way it actually came out and really blown away by the well-wishers. You know, I didn't think I'd receive that level of support, you know. I didn't realise I'd get that type of reception.
Yeah, you used the word creative there, and it was very creative. And I guess footballers nowadays are becoming more creative beings with social media and the rest of it. But I guess that particular video and a poem isn't the stereotypical type of behaviour we're used to from a footballer. And I suppose my question to you is, what is the stereotypical footballer these days? I mean, has it changed from when you first started out in the game, do you think?
Not necessarily, you know. Groups and team dynamics are still the same, and they still play out the same way. It takes a lot of courage, you know, to stand on your own, stand on your two feet as a young man, especially in social circles and within the workplace. And these are universal teams, you know. These aren't just about what happens on the pitch. These are labelled and branded as being footballers and young men and stuff, but it happens in many other different environments and different settings. It could be an office, could be a building site. You know, it could be absolutely anywhere, and the word itself, stereotype and stuff, you know, you'd have to look at that and really start to how overwhelming that is at times to step into that environment and to try to belong within a certain group of players and stuff. And we're all searching for really is to be loved and to belong within those circles.
I mean, look, you're quite a considered, thoughtful, philosophical character. We speak a lot of modern footballers, and I mean, I always like to bring this podcast back to psychological matters. And I know that psychology for you is a big part of what you're about and something that you've studied quite a lot from what I understand.
Yeah, and it was great when we connected and you were telling me your background and what you're doing, and it's absolutely amazing and stuff. And obviously, you know, being fellow keepers and fellow goalkeepers is that we are quite, as you said, philosophical. We do have to witness and observe a lot. So I was always, I suppose, philosophy, love of knowledge. It was always a love for learning. I always wanted to learn more. I always had that ability to all the time, continually, that personal development and stuff. So that's when I started, I suppose, looking at different dynamics in certain situations. And especially football taught me a lot. You know, football taught me, especially as a goalkeeper, many, many life skills and life lessons. And along the lines of communication, how we communicate with people, you know, how we communicate with our defenders, how we communicate with the different, you know, midfielders, the centre forwards, managers, staff, fans, whoever it actually be, you know, and the power of communication and how we can observe, how we can witness, you know, our spatial awareness. There's so much within the game and so much within being a goalkeeper that relates on the pitch as well as off it. You know, once you're on the pitch, you're in a different world as such, but once you come off it, you still honour those life skills.
On that note, because I certainly found this myself playing, in that being a goalkeeper and being in a lot of the situations that you're in, both well, physically, I suppose technically to an extent, but certainly a lot of the situations you'd be, certainly psychologically, how has that shaped you from when you were, say, a 16-year-old goalkeeper to the goalkeeper you were before retirement? I actually came and watched you a couple of times at Cambridge, for instance, and one of the big things for me, you touched on communication, was that I could see that although maybe you weren't necessarily as powerful as you might have been 10 years prior, you were really ordering that defence around, and you were a very solid defensive unit, and a lot of that would have been your communication skills. So how did you see yourself develop, but also your goalkeeping game develop from, say, being a 16-year-old to being in your latter 30s?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's just confidence and confidence in your ability. You know, we grew up as young men, and the coaches I dealt with back home in Galway, the likes of Tommy Lally and different people, Joe Riley and stuff, these were young coaches of mine that had experience in the game and stuff. And the one thing the senior goalkeepers always spoke about was communication is the most important thing. And at the time, you don't really see how empowering it actually is when the effects it can have on the people around you. Because you can be a bit shook in yourself and you're a bit young, you might be a bit overwhelmed, you might be a bit naive, you might be thinking, oh my God, if I say something to the centre half here, if he turns around and gives me a rollicking, or if I don't deliver that message in the right manner, in the right way, your intention might be right, but how it's delivered might not necessarily come across in that way. I suppose learning those skills from such a young age that when you're 16, then you start to develop and you start to mature. And one of the greatest goalkeeping coaches I had was a gentleman called Tony Burns. Just to watch the man in the way he actually communicated. And that's exactly what it was. It was maturity as a man that you start to step in and take ownership of your role as a number one goalkeeper. And if you want to hold that, you want to maintain it, it takes, you know, a lot of responsibility to step into that space. So from 16 up until the space I got to now, I really started to understand the dynamics of, I suppose, good types of communication, the different modes of communication, you know, and the different energies that's actually needed and stuff to get the specific and get a good result at the end of the day. And then I started to discover that a lot of the time you could have people in the right place and the right space. And as a goalkeeper, we come off the pitch and you hear the media, you hear the press, we won 3-0 or we won 1-0. You didn't really have a lot to do. Hang on a second, like, we've just expanded serious amount of energy, yeah, communicating, telling defenders man on, this and that. And we have done a lot to affect that game. But it just goes unseen, like a lot of things behind the scenes. You know, you don't see the unseen stuff. And a lot of goalkeeper work is in the unseen world.
No, I love that you said that. So one of the biggest things I learned from psychology was the idea that communication isn't what's said, it's what's received. Now, we get a lot of goalkeeper coaches, a lot of young goalkeepers that listen to this podcast. That for me there, and you imagine putting yourself in the shoes of one of your defenders and actually having someone behind you that is talking with passion, quite an assertive way in which you can talk, and actually giving good direction and helping build them up. The difference you can make to them psychologically, their energy levels, you know, it's a real simple thing. But of course, if you're able to offer that to them and you're talking with that kind of tone of voice for 90, 95 minutes, no one's ever going to see that. And no one will ever know it except your goalkeeping geeks out there that might come to a game and watch a goalkeeper at close quarters and understand the impact that a goalkeeper can have on the back four, on the midfield, just with the tone of voice and understanding how to communicate in different ways, by the way, because not every defender is the same psychologically. So how do you get the best of that particular person in front of you?
Yeah, you're spot on there. You've nailed a lot of things. You know, one is tone. You know, sometimes my pitch has been known to be piercing, nearly ringing. You know, I could nearly smash glass with it. Like, and I actually surprised myself with it. Yeah. And then other times it has to be deep to emphasize, you know, the point I want to get across. Plus, as well, as you touched on there as well, which is on point, is your body language. What type of body language? We're led to believe that 30% of our oral communication is through the sound, through our voice, and the rest is mainly through our body language and tonality and all those lines of things. Like, so as you start growing, like we were saying earlier, as I started to grow in myself as a goalkeeper, I started to see these little intricacies and these little dynamics that were having huge effects on defenders. And then with experience, you know, comes the fact of when not to use them. You know, at the times when you're naive and you're young, I was more of a passive-aggressive state. And that aggressiveness that was actually in me because of my will to win and stuff was totally misunderstood, you know.
Yeah.
Well, so when I started to understand then about being passive-assertive, I got a whole different level of outcomes. And as you said, by the time I came to Cambridge, I was more comfortable in myself and my ability to express that across.
Yeah, one story actually I heard from an ex-teammate of mine who has you down as, you might know this, Scott Barron,
who's
at Millwall, but he still has you down, which well, he says you're comfortably the best goalkeeper he's ever played with, who the fact he said comfortably, I took a little bit of offence to, because I don't think I was that bad, but hey-ho. But no, he told me one story once, because he said, like, in terms of communication, he said how good you were. He said once, though, where he actually gave you a little bit back. I think he answered you back in a game, and he said you literally had him up in the change room at half-time, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, I remember the game well, like, you know, and it was Swindon away. And I suppose at the time in the space I was actually at, I was always a late developer. It was always felt like a rescue mission for me. It always felt I was trying to claw back time, you know. I came into the game late. I didn't go through the orthodox route of academies and everything else. So it was all new to me. So when I got my chance, and when Kenny Jackett thankfully gave me opportunity as a number one goalkeeper at Millwall, I was 26, nearly 27 years of age, and I always felt then that, right, I want to get into the Championship, you know, I'd love to play in the Premier League, give me one cap for Ireland, I'm delighted. So my sense of achievement and that desire and will to win was fueled by that, and anyone that would have overstepped the boundaries in my focus and in my concentration, there was times I handled it perfectly, and then there was other times I stepped the mark, you know. But having deep reflection on that and looking back at those incidents, what actually happened with Scotty was wrong, so I must actually apologise. So Scotty, if you're listening, I apologise, brother. But he took it in good spirits, because he knew the type of person I was and what I was trying to just lead the team on and drive the team constantly for us to achieve, because I knew if the team were successful, I was going to be successful. For me, I was always had my individuality, but ultimately, I'm a team man. I love the team environment. I love playing team sports. So just to give you, that was a bit of the kind of context around it, you know, and we were playing Swindon away up at the City Ground, and I think it was a Tuesday night, and they were flying high in the league as well. And it was a big game, you know, there was a lot of pressure on. We were going for the playoffs. They were going for the playoffs. And I passed the ball out to them, and I passed it a bit too hard, and Scotty turns around and he starts pointing a finger and giving me a bit of stick on the pitch, which slightly irritated me, because what I felt was that he's digging me out on the pitch by pointing fingers, and he's highlighting, showing me up on the pitch for my mistake and my error. So I pulled him afterwards, and I got in the dressing room, and I managed to grab him by the scruff of the neck and up against the wall, which was, it's not right what I did, but at that time in my space and where I was in myself, it was just letting him know that that's not right to treat me that way in front of, you know, maybe 10, 12, 15,000 people. Yeah. You know, I said, next time you want to speak to me in that manner, I says, we either talk in the tunnel or we do it in the change room. You know, out on the pitch in front of everyone is not the right place to do it. So he learned a lot on that, and so did I. But it just all stemmed from that will to win and that drive to be the best.
That happens so often in games where you'll see it's almost the second when someone does point the finger, or the one that gets me is where they'll come and like pat you on the back and almost be like sympathetic if you made a mistake. Like everyone knows you've made a mistake, and all they're doing is compounding it. That's one. The other bit I'm so glad you did it to Scotty. It couldn't have happened to a nicer guy than you. I will not be passing that apology on. So we'll see if he's listening.
He still hasn't let it go on either, has he?
He's mentioned it to me so many times.
That's about 20 years ago.
David, we're going to get on to the rest of your career in a moment or so, and obviously the journey that you took that you referenced just there. But just to finish up on the psychology stuff, because this is really fascinating, and I know that Rich, for one, is absolutely loving it. But I read a quote from you in which you describe yourself as emotionally illiterate. And there have been times in your career you've been open about with regards to anxiety and self-doubt. And again, I know Rich can certainly relate to that. But that emotionally illiterate quote, what exactly did you mean by that?
At the time, I was basically starting to understand my emotions. I didn't understand my emotions. I find it very hard. I was very physically strong. I was very mentally strong. And then when it came to emotions, I didn't really understand them. I couldn't actually digest my feelings, what was actually going on for me. I found it hard to embody that. I found it hard to really, emotions were a language I didn't understand. So I started delving into the roots, into the meanings and into the depths of the emotions. That has been, you know, an unbelievably liberating experience. It all stemmed from times when I was, say, a young kid, young professional, even up to this day, and going through those different bouts, I suppose, of anxiety, self-doubt, you know, that we can all relate to those interfering thoughts, those interfering habits, and those interfering emotions.
And you started, correct me if I've pronounced this wrong, is it Japa meditation or Yapa meditation? How is that pronounced?
Yeah, it's Japa meditation, but ultimately it was a focus on meditation and the time I dedicated to self-reflection. You know, I've been practicing meditation for a year now. I practice many forms, you know, and only recently I finished some meditations with a shaman from Bolivia, from the Bolivian Amazon. And then early in the year, I went to the reservations in Arizona and America, and been to the Himalayas many times, you know, in search of their ancient knowledge and in their teachings. And I live for that buzz, really, you know. It just gives me that other sense of fulfillment and life enrichment, and starting to, like what I was saying, it wasn't only the love for learning the craft of goalkeeping, it was trying to understand and learn the art of living and the whole science of thinking. So meditation really just allowed me to sit with myself and started to understand those many different layers around my own psychology, around my own emotional well-being, what started coming up to the surface, how they were actually affecting my performance, not only as an elite athlete, but ultimately as, you know, a human being and a person on the day-to-day living. And ultimately for me, meditation is a practice, and it's a practice of one-pointed, focused concentration. And then we started to realize that had a huge impact. Then it started to have an authority over me. And then ultimately it helped with my confidence. And I helped start to grow in confidence, and it started to work on my esteem. And then obviously the autonomy came from that, you know, the ability to get my desired results. So it was a huge practice for me, you know, and it blew me out of the open. And it was something that I've been searching for since I was a young boy, like, you know. So it was really phenomenal experience, and just getting to understand, you know, who I am and how I am and where I am. So that was the basis of it, really. And just other forms of meditations, whether it be breathing, whether it be playing music or listening to music, or there's many, many different types of meditations that we don't even understand sometimes that we're in a meditative state.
Do you know what? I mean, I've never taken it to the levels that you have, but I did, something I did do is I did a week in India in a community. It was a community where there was no money. So it was one of these where it was you exchanging services,
yeah,
and lots of meditation, lots of yoga. And I'll tell you what it is, the thing that's fascinated me there is that learning about yourself. And a lot of the challenge there was this realization of ego and how actually your ego can limit you to an extent, because you build this idea up as to what you are and what life is, and you can be quite confined in that. And suddenly it was this feeling where you take that away, because there isn't any, well, there's no money for a start. So the people you're conversing with, that's an irrelevance. So this kind of idea you build up in your mind as to who you are, what you are, was an absolute irrelevance when you're in this community. Now, for me, the reason I mention this, and this might be a bit deep for a lot of people listening in who are just looking to improve their goalkeeping, for instance, but the bit for me then came back to, it might be a little bit of a tangent, not going to lie, but the bit for me then came back to balance, because the realizations I had during that week was that you can be caught in this idea as to what you are, what goalkeeping is, the feelings you get when you go out to play a game, the nervousness, the anxiety, the pressure, everything else. But actually putting yourself in a different environment, it changed my mindset towards what it was that I was doing. And actually that in itself can then release you to allow you to improve your goalkeeping game, because a lot of it does ultimately come back to balance. If all you've got going on and you're just in your head all the time thinking about goalkeeping, thinking about mistakes, thinking about the game itself, actually sometimes you might create a limit for yourself, where if you're able to create that balance, you're able to reflect on what it is that you do, then you might be able to unlock different parts of you, which in time can then offer different improvement. Does that make sense?
No, 100%. I totally get that sense of balance and harmony within your performance as a goalkeeper. And for me, it was about understanding freedom and liberation from interfering and disabling thoughts and disabling emotions that were having an impact on my performance. And then starting to bring in a balance. Well, I want to give myself the nourishment and the food and the soul food that would actually nourish me as a person, as a whole. Then ultimately, I started to realize that, you know, I wasn't actually being myself. I wasn't being David Ford. I was being somebody to fit into a group and fit into a team dynamic, which I was just betraying myself and denying myself so many things just to be part of the team and to be part of the group, because that's all I wanted to be. And that's what I wanted to be, part of the team. And I lost a lot of my individuality. And I think when we go talking about stereotypes, that's what we actually do. We lose our sense of individuality. And it's about what I hear you saying about having that balance. It's about having the balance between, I am an individual. You know, I look at some of the individuals I played with and they were some of the best. David James, what a phenomenal man, phenomenal character. I was, you know, spent some phenomenal years with that man, and, you know, his creative genius, his artistic side, his goalkeeping was phenomenal, and just an absolute boss man. And, you know, like Paolo Di Canio and all these other people, but they still had, you know, that will to win and to be part of teams and stuff. But when I started to understand those dynamics, that it's still okay to be an individual, but ultimately when you're in that team, it's all about the team. We all say, you know, down through the years, the old adage is no I in team, but we take me and we turn the W or the M upside down and we get we. So me to we, and that type of thing. Like, you know, so when I started to understand those layers and those dynamics about, as you said, bringing in that balance, it was bringing in the balance of myself. You know, we talk about ego, and, you know, I hear that word a lot, and I started to really understand that and start to really study it. And what is ego? Ego just means identity and what we identify ourselves with. And once we begin to identify it with that sense, then we form an attachment to that. So if someone comes and challenges in that space and we begin to lose a sense of face, we lose a sense of that identity, we'll try to survive our best in that. The claws come out, the fists come out, and if we haven't got those skill sets, those beyond those survival mechanisms, survival, those tools, it can end up as carnage. I can definitely see, yeah, you're on point when it does come to that balance. And I think as footballers, you know, and as young goalkeepers, we've always been individuals, you know, at the goalkeepers union. We've always been on the outside trying to get in with the players. They're giving us stick. We're on the outside. When we're making saves, like you said, they're patting on your back, giving you high fives. One goes through your legs. No one talks to you. You're sat there, head down. And you don't know what to do with yourself. So you're all the time trying to find that balance. Like you fit in and you don't fit in, you leg in, leg out, you don't know where you are sometimes, you know. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Two names you mentioned previously there, David James and Paolo Di Canio. You arrived at West Ham in the early noughties when you were looking for your big break. David James, what did you actually learn from him? Because we've had a lot of players who have played with David James on this podcast, a lot of coaches who have coached David James on this podcast. And a general perception overall for David James is that he was one of the good goalkeepers in the Premier League, but never a great from some fans. He obviously had that tag, Calamity James, for a while when he was at Liverpool. But I know that for Rich, he's one of his favourite goalkeepers growing up and observing when he was becoming a pro. What was he like to work with and what did you learn from him?
For me, David James was one of the best goalkeepers in the Premier League. And there's many players I've spoke to down the ranks since. And if you speak to ex-players and players he's actually played with, Sol Campbell and these types of men that have played behind him and seen the presence, what he actually had. What I learned from David James was his sense of courage. You know, the man got knocked down 6 or 7 times, he got up 8. Every time, knocked down 10, he got up 11. And it didn't stop him, you know. He had a huge ability and a huge courage that, right, they talked about Calamity James, he might drop a cross, he might drop one corner, but 9 times out of 10, he came and took that cross, or he made that punch, or made that clearance. And then for that one error, he got absolutely lambasted, which at the time was unfairly, I felt, because when you go to watch the man and how hard he actually worked and the love he had for our craft was amazing. Like what you said there, I just think, you know, his courage and what he taught me was that sometimes we are going to get it wrong and being too hard on ourselves. And I was very hard on myself for making a mistake. We all make mistakes. So it's when we start making errors, and that's a continual many, many mistakes. Then we can start asking questions. But when these were just happening, incidences here and there, when I signed for Portsmouth, Paul Cook was phenomenal for me for that season down at Fratton Park, and that's what he said to me. He said, I want you to come, that's what you're good at, come and take crosses. And he says, I do understand you're going to get one or two of them wrong, but he said 9 times out of 10 you're going to help the team out. And what that gives the team, it gives the team a sense of safety and a sense of security. And that's what it's about, as being a goalkeeper, is having a level of consistency that, right, you might drop 1 out of 10, but it's not going to be 4 or 5, you know. And then that gives the manager confidence, it gives the back four confidence, goes right up through the spine of the team, like an energy right up through the team. And that's what I learned from David James, really, was just his ability to keep going, keep doing what he believed in. And, you know, I've seen him doing some things in training that were beyond human, you know.
Yeah, that's something I want to touch on about your game in particular, because, you know, something I remember of you, like you say, very positive on coming for crosses. One of my, I say issues, but there's a lot of goalkeepers I feel that aren't necessarily all that effective, but they'll play more not to make a mistake as opposed to playing to play well. So,
absolutely.
You know, I look at, and you're right, David James, I look at, and I've got the same opinion of you, because actually, in terms of being effective, he's coming and affecting the game so much more than your average goalkeeper.
Yeah.
But of course, because I suppose the knowledge of goalkeeping is still so poor, people will pick up on the error as opposed to the five good things you do. So what would be your advice, say, to a young goalkeeper in terms of how they play, especially given that they might have a Sunday League manager, for instance, that won't necessarily notice the five crosses they come for? He'll notice the one that they come and drop that costs them the goal, for instance. So you see a lot of goalkeepers might then go into their shell.
I think for me, goalkeeping is about, it's a whole journey about consistency. You know, the more consistent we come, the higher up the leagues and higher up the levels we actually come. But ultimately, it takes perseverance to build, and then consistency to keep it. So when we consistently be, you know, how I like to look at it and how I used to kind of, in my mad mind, view things, like, you know, whether it was right or wrong, but it worked for me, you know. I thought the top keepers and the top players, and having played against some of them around the world and stuff, you know, that they had a level of consistency that every game they were a solid, you know, 8 or 9 every game. Then you came down, say, that's Premier League, then you come down into the Championship and it might be a 7 or 8. And then you go back down League One, it might have been 6 to 7. And in some weeks, you know, League Two or conference level, you had 5 or 6s, where they were going from a consistency level of, you know, 5 or 6 every week, or to an 8 or 9 or 10. So it didn't have that level of consistency. And then you didn't have that sense of security for teams and players and stuff. So once we started to understand, like what you're saying, when you start to bring that balance into yourself, you start to balance yourself on performance levels as well. So you start to bring that consistency into your game, and the more consistent, the more you can play at an 8 or a 9 every week, the more successful you'll be as a goalkeeper.
Lays it back, there's a header from Ball, and it's goal! Oh, what a save from not... David Ford, that was in! And somehow Ford, diving back towards his own goal, manages to tip it over the bar.
You won't see a better save than that at the Den all season. Stunning, absolutely stunning from David Ford, world class.
So in terms of your career, a very unique career path, I suppose you could say, and not many who would have had a similar career trajectory. We do speak to a lot of keepers who come into their pro careers late, and you went back and forth. You were obviously at Barry. You mentioned the go you had at West Ham. That was your first chance at the big break. It didn't quite work out. You went back to Ireland with Galway and Derry, and then you returned with Cardiff. And it was only at Millwall in the late noughties, when you were in your late 20s, that you got your big break. What was it that kept you going, I suppose, that made that fire in your belly still think that this was possible for you? Because a lot of people that listen into this, and we actually get a lot of emails from goalkeepers that say, can I still make it pro? I'm in my mid-20s and I was at a pro club, and then I got released, and now I'm playing in the nether regions of the English football pyramid and non-league. Can I still get there?
I've done, you know, a lot of work with my own mentor around this, and through the years and stuff, it was a sense of injustice that, you know, I felt through as a young lad coming through the years and levels, that I didn't get my opportunities, I didn't take my chances. Oftentimes when I did get chances, or when I did have opportunities, I didn't have that sense of discipline in terms of my behaviours and how I was acting off the field in terms of alcohol, nights out, you know. So when I started to understand that, when I started to look at those dynamics of how I was behaving off the field, it had an impact on how I was operating on it, you know. And then I started to get those kind of lucky breaks and things started to happen. It was really about when I started to uncover that kind of consistency within myself and starting to work in through those layers.
There have obviously been so many landmark moments in your career. I know you had a bust-up with a player when you were at Barry Town, an on-pitch bust-up with a fellow player. There was a brawl at Bradford, which is rather interesting. I'd love to know whether you speak to John Stead or whether you spoke to him afterwards in that clash between Bradford and Millwall many moons ago. There was a penalty save against Jermaine Beckford in the playoffs. That was huge. You had promotions with Millwall, of course. There was also, there's a great clip on YouTube of you launching a ball right into the centre-back of Millwall, Sid Nelson's head. Do you recall that? He didn't seem happy.
Oh, my God, yeah, that was carnage. That was, like, I remember it just happening. Like, you know, it was like, when you bring it back to me, you know, it just goes through me. I think it was even live on Sky as well. Like, you know, it was one of the most random, bizarre incidences. So like we were saying earlier, I think a cross came deep into the box around the penalty spot, and I had come and claimed it, and I thought, right, I can set us on a counter-attack here and shell one down the down into the right-hand channel, like, you know, get the right winger away. And next thing, young Sid Nelson, you know, fresh-eyed, you know, straight from the U team, comes on, and he just starts running across me path, like, you know, and as I'm about to deliver, I can see him actually out of the corner of my eye. And next thing, I'm volleyed up straight off the side of his ear. I couldn't hear for a week. Welcome to senior football. And I was just like going, oh my God, Sid, what's going on here? Like, you know, yeah, that wasn't one of my proudest moments in a Millwall shirt and stuff, but there's been so many, you know, to retire and get to this state of football, you know, and to, you know, just totally embrace and embellish the game, that it was just an amazing journey. As you said, highlights there, penalty saves in playoff finals, winning playoff finals, you know, playing for my country. There was so many unbelievable highs. Like, you know, there was times it felt like a roller coaster and you're going around the roller coaster and then the straps would break loose and then you're hanging on for dear life by your fingertips and then you're back in it again and straps are on and you're going smooth. Like, you know, it just, it was such an amazing experience.
Yeah, and we'll just finish on Ireland. You obviously bagged your debut under Giovanni Trapattoni, I believe it was. You were 33 at the time, which is an incredible milestone at that age. You made your full debut against Italy. You starred in that clash with England, the first time that Ireland had played in England for 18 years. You starred in that game. You obviously went to Euro 2012.
It was always my dream and my ambition to, you know, I used to have Tony Burns pester every some Monday morning when I'd come into Calmont Road at the training ground. I'd be like, right, what's the scores? What's the results? Desperate to get call up for Ireland. And then as I started to get that just a bit older, and then I started to lose my grip on it. You know, I just thought, right, I started to resolve that in myself and reconcile that in myself, that, you know what, this is probably gone past me now. So then that gave me a huge sense of freedom in that as well, because I was so desperate for it that I got so uptight in it that, you know, and especially it was so dangerous, as he said to me, you know, he said, you just got to relax and enjoy and step into your, be more comfortable in yourself, that I started making bigger saves. I wasn't so uptight, my wingspan, as he used to call it, or I started making just those incremental differences in saves and bigger saves at more crucial times. So then we were up at Burnley away at Turf Moor, and I remember Josh Wright stuck a volley from about 30 yards into the top corner. We won 3-0 championship in the same year. I think I kept 20, 21 clean sheets. So Alan Kelly was at the game and we were back down the M62, and like that, a few of us were playing a game of cards. And I get a phone call from Alan Kelly. He says, hi, Alan. David, he said, this is Alan Kelly here from the FAI on behalf of Giovanni Trapattoni and Marco Tardelli and myself. We'd like to include you for the upcoming qualifier against, I think it was Macedonia. Jesus, I was speechless. Totally just blew me mind. I remember just looking out over the moors as it was coming down and it was wet and windy, and this sense of emotion just came from the depths, like, you know, and these tears started rolling down my eyes. The next thing, the lads are all playing cards and they stop and they're looking at this lad, 6'4", in tears, sitting on a bus going, has someone just died, like, you know? So then as I started to come around to it and I started to let them know, I was absolutely in shock, like, you know? And the lads were all buzzing for me, all delighted and stuff. So managed to get in and get involved with the squads. And then all of a sudden I found myself, you know, after Shea retired, being number one for my country, which I never thought even possible. I never even thought I'd get one cap. Got called in at 31, and then 33 years of age, being the oldest. I don't know whether to be proud of this one or whether to be embarrassed. 33 years of age playing a European qualifier, you know, so away to Sweden. So, yeah, it was just been totally phenomenal. And to have the likes of someone like Giovanni Trapattoni, the godfather of management, you know, backing you and giving you the number shirt was, it was overwhelming because of the space I was in it myself at the time, but it was just an amazing time.
Just because that story about Euro 2016 is quite interesting, because you did get a call up into that game and you came off the bench to play, and there was a really interesting interaction between you and Kieran Westwood, wasn't there? Can you just describe what that was like? And I've read a quote that you said you knew, even though you were brought off the bench, you knew then that you weren't going to be going to the tournament.
Yeah, we'd come over and it was a really difficult time, because this game was on the Tuesday and or the Wednesday in Cork, and it was the first time I think an international has been played outside of Dublin, you know, and Cork are such passionate football fans, huge, huge sport fans in general, you know, in terms of Gaelic and hurling and stuff. So there was a huge turnout. So I'd flown over on the Monday morning, and take into account that we just lost the playoff final to Barnsley. They pumped us 2-0 or 3-0 to go back into the championship. So that was a bit of a tough one to take. And then I had to, you know, pack my bags, get ready, and with the thought of I could be gone here for 4, 5, 6 weeks maybe. So get me big bags, arrive in Cork, had to go do me medicals for UEFA and all that kind of protocols. And then we trained at Turner's Cross. And so I just felt from once I arrived, I had that innate feeling that, you know, I wasn't going to be going. So we played a game against Belarus and the game was going on and stuff. And next thing, Martin turns around and he says, 40, get ready. And Kieran just turns to me and he says, well, he said, that's me, done 40. I'm not going, though. And I turned around to him and I says, no, I said, in fact, it's the other way around, Kieran. I says, I play tonight, but you'll travel. And I just knew, my intuition told me that's what was going to happen. And true to my word to Kieran, that's what did happen.
Incredible story, and I say it's really inspirational for a lot of our listeners, no doubt. We mentioned the fact that so many, I guess, are having similar situations when they're a little bit younger and still dream of the big time. So hopefully they're taking a lot from this podcast. But the last thing we ask every single guest that we have on is the same question, and we get a variety of different answers, and I'm quite intrigued as to what your answer will be. David Ford, what has goalkeeping given you?
Goalkeeping has given me everything. Absolutely everything. It has given me so much in life. It has given my family so much in life. It has given me everything, really. It's such a hard one to answer, and it's a great actual question. What has goalkeeping given me? It's given me a sense of who I am, you know, a sense of where I am and what I am, when I am. It's given me a love for a sport and for a craft that I absolutely adore and love. I love the dynamics and the intricacies and, you know, the whole technical aspect of goalkeeping. It's such a beautiful art when you just break it down into its art form. It's given me a sense of teamwork. It's given me a sense of love for people and a community as a whole. It's given me such an understanding of the fans and that relationship between players and fans. And ultimately, it's given me a relationship with myself, ultimately, you know, and if I can have a better relationship with myself, then relationships with everyone else will follow suit. So in terms of what it's actually given me, is that's all I can actually say. It's given me so much, because it has fulfilled and enriched my life in way beyond ways that I didn't possibly think it could happen. And that's just from the power of love of football and the power and the love of goalkeeping.
So that's your life in goalkeeping, David. You've hung up your gloves. You're looking ahead to what's next. And what is next? What's next for David Ford?
Yeah, what's next? It's very exciting, actually. You know, it's been a great transition over the last few years to come from professional football. And now we've opened up our company in coaching, mentoring, personal development business. So we have an office that's based in Hoxton in East London. And really, through what I started to realize over my 20-year career, when I made so many mistakes, I learned so much, you know, through study and personal development. I felt I had a lot to share with people. And also, I wanted, you know, to help and support people ultimately in achieving their dreams as I did mine. So now I have a new vision for my future. So I suppose, what does that incorporate? It's along the lines, you know, working with individuals, working with teams, working with companies, building leadership qualities, communication skills, emotional intelligence and high performance. So if anyone would like to keep up with the journey, you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and my website, pcd.ie, will be up and running very soon.
Amazing. You're a Hoxton hipster, David.
I am. I'm going all hip in my old age, like, you know. I think I need to get a full-grown beard and a couple of tattoos and all that, like having a midlife crisis.
mate, you don't want to get to Richard Lee stage, I tell you. It's not a good place to be.
Richard Lee is fairly dapper now. I've seen him down through the years. He's a dapper man.
Okay, David Ford, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a million, gents.
Well, I don't know why I bother, mate, to be honest with you.
What do you mean?
Didn't need to be here at all, did I there? Absolutely didn't need to be. I go away and I get all these stats and these facts. I do all this research and then you just hog the mic talking about psychology.
You're talking about meditation in the Amazon. Yeah. Fantastic.
No, listen, learned a lot there. Really, really insightful stuff from David Ford. And whether this is me being ignorant, I don't know. I'd never heard of that turn the W upside down from we and you get me. I'm actually doing...
You're doing the action
doing
right
the action
now.
Here.
Yeah.
I never heard that before.
No, so out of that whole interview, that's what you've taken from it. Is that the key nugget of information?
That was actually something that really stood out for me because I'd never heard it before.
But this is it. And do you know what, actually, for me, because there was so much we covered in that interview, and I'd love to know what you guys think of it as well. Like, look, that was quite deep, a lot of that, because like I've studied parts of psychology, of course. It's something I'm really interested in, but I'm aware of David Ford's journey. And the fact is that he's taken certain things to much deeper depths than I have. And hopefully through some of that, you took something from it. Where I think for me, like a key message he's talking about is balance. You know, when he talks about meditation, he's talking about the various things he's doing. A lot of it comes back to that is balance, because ultimately... There's another saying that you keep doing what you've always done, you'll get what you've always got. Now, if you can change the script slightly, if you can try something a little bit different that might open your mind in a slightly different way, it might offer you a different level for improvement. And I think that's the key thing I took from a lot of that, is that he's finding different ways in order to grow more as a person.
And just on his career, I mean, we spoke a lot about psychology. We touched upon his career, but it really is inspiring, I think, for some goalkeepers, because he did go back and forth from Wales to Ireland, eventually got the break with Millwall, having not got it at West Ham. It didn't work out for him there. He said he had off-field problems. There's some other bits and pieces, like he thought he was going to get a loan move to Bournemouth. He was on his way to the club, got a phone call saying that was cancelled. There was a chance he was going to go on loan to Dundee United at one point, but the SFA blocked it because he'd already been on loan at an English club and a Welsh club. So he kept on having these backwards and forwards moments in his career, but it eventually came to fruition with Millwall so late in his career. And then in the twilight of his career, you mentioned you watched him at Cambridge. He also went to Portsmouth and won the league with Portsmouth. He missed two or three games, but 19 clean sheets as a, you know, 37, 38 year old.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary. Look, now I use the word inspirational, and it is, because you're right. How many times do we get questions from older goalkeepers asking us, is there still a chance for me? Now, we'll always be honest, and I'll always be honest and say that the older you get, if you've not quite made it into the league, of course, it's going to be tough. Certainly given the structure of how football is now, where a lot of it is based on resale value and bringing in younger players and almost more of a business now than perhaps it was. But that being said, of course there is a chance. And I think a big part of it is, another saying for you, a setback is a setup for a comeback. Look, you're going to have setback after setback after setback. He touched on David James. The biggest quality for him that David James had was how brave he was. The bravery and the courage to put himself up for it again and again and again. You think of the amount of mistakes that David James made. You think of the amount of times that he was the back page for the wrong reasons. And yet, he played more games than anyone. You know, he was continually there week after week. And that as well was a big part of the interview for me, that it obviously applies to David Ford. It applies to certain people that he spoke about. And if you can have that mentality that you are just continually growing, finding a way to improve, then in time, good things will happen. It may not be instantly, but in time, good things will happen.
And he did mention his next venture there, Pathfinder Coaching and Development. You can find that on pcd.ie. So be sure to give that one a look.
Yeah, I'll just have a quick note on that, because I think it's something that's been key for me in my career as well. You know, I've had, and I know a lot of successful people have a mentor. You know, I've certainly had one, the psychologist I've spoke to over the years and people I've spoke to who have been where I want to be. Now, this isn't just to help him and plug him, but I think there is something to that. It's certainly worth exploring, because I think maybe even if it's not a David Ford, to have somebody that can offer you the script for what it is that you want to do. So if you are a young goalkeeper, can you find people, whether that be in terms of reading books, reading the right books of goalkeepers maybe that you admire, or finding people that can offer you that advice, because again, it can help you avoid so many pitfalls.
Absolutely, it can. Well, this was the Goalkeepers Union podcast for another week. A slightly different end to the show this time out. Over to Mr. Ford.
I'm familiar with uncertainty. I'm not a stranger to the fog. I've stumbled through the darkness till I've reached a welcome dawn. Stillness has become a teammate when I learnt how to listen. Every storm I faced has helped me go the distance. From simple days of playful focus, climbing steadily up these hills, chasing wants, a need for greatness, a dream I live to fulfill. I've worn the crests of hallowed clubs, I've worn our shade of green, for the people of my island, and for the game that set me free. humbled by the fans, with each and every game, inspired by their songs, they fuel my burning flame. When looking to the night sky, with dark sapphires amongst the stars, I sense the time has come for a new journey of mine to start. It's time for me to lay down my gloves with a heart full of gratitude and love. And I'd like to say thank you to my family, the fans and my friends, to my coaches, mentors, teachers and teammates that have walked alongside me throughout the years. Thank you for the memories, for the honour, for the love of the beautiful game.